Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 465, The Gipper and the Underground Reich. This is being recorded on June 20th of the year 2004. In recent weeks, we've seen a long media hagiography of Ronald Reagan's presidency, and what we're going to do in this program is to take a look at some of the realities of Ronald Reagan's presidency, presidencies, as opposed to the media hype of same. As an encapsulation, sort of a microcosm for and a metaphor for the profound difference between Ronald Reagan's presidency as a political reality and Ronald Reagan's presidency as a media fantasy, we're going to turn to a short section of For the Record program number 304, titled Illegal Procedure. Now, this program is about the National Football League, but in the introduction to the book that comprises the bulk of the material for that broadcast, a book called Interference by Dan Moldea. That book is about organized crime in the NFL, and in the beginning of that book, he talks about the reality of Frank Gipp, the Notre Dame football player whom Ronald Reagan played in the movie Newt Rockne, All-American. It was that player's nickname, the Gipper, that Reagan adopted as his political moniker, and what we're going to talk about now is the difference between the celluloid Hollywood fantasy of Frank Gipp as embodied by Ronald Reagan, who played him, and the reality of Frank Gipp. And this is a metaphor for the difference between the reality of Ronald Reagan's presidency and the fantasy that has been presented to the American people ad nauseum in recent weeks. This, again, is from For the Record 304. In the prologue to Interference, Dan Moldea writes as follows. Years before he became president of the United States, actor Ronald Reagan portrayed Notre Dame's George Gipp in the 1940 Warner Brothers movie Newt Rockne, All-American. Gipp had died of pneumonia in December of 1920 after an illustrious college football career. His purported deathbed request to Rockne, "Win just one for the Gipper," unquote, was used during a locker room pep talk and helped to inspire Rockne's 1928 team in its upset victory against Army. And as the Gipper incarnate, Reagan used the line to inspire voters to elect him to the California Governor's Mansion and later the White House. To those who saw the movie and listened to Reagan utter those now famous words, Gipp epitomized the virtues of good character, sportsmanship, and the right way of living, unquote. History, however, now shows that Gipp, a man of truly questionable moral values, probably never made any such request on or off his deathbed. That Rockne, who was known for grasping at anything to incite his players, had fabricated the incident, and that Reagan's movie further embellished the Gipp-Rockne charade. Hollywood, which is notorious for cooking up such fantasies as the Gipp-Rockne story, realizes that most Americans view sports as a vehicle of inspiration and entertainment. Thus, sports history is routinely manipulated. Left unquestioned, stories like that of the Gipper become permanent fixtures of Americana. Regardless of the facts, the American public continues to believe the legend of George Gipp's deathbed request to Newt Rockne. The difficulties in debunking the myth about one college coach and one of his players is an indication of the problems in dispelling the legends about an entire institution, particularly one as popular as football. Powerful forces in America have built empires around these myths, and the preservation of these empires and the personal wealth of those who own them depend upon the maintenance of the legends. In the Reagan movie myth of the lives of Rockne and Gipp, there is one scene in which Rockne chases away a gambler who's looking for an edge. Rockne, played by actor Pat O'Brien, tells him, quote, "We haven't got any use for gamblers around here. You've done your best to ruin baseball and horse racing. This is one game that's clean, and it's going to stay clean," unquote. Considering that Gipp, with the knowledge of Rockne, was a notorious sports gambler, the O'Brien quote perhaps best illustrates my point. To a large degree, the National Football League, the NFL, has become the embodiment of the Gipp-Rockne myth. It has wrapped itself around the American flag and strutted into America's homes to the thrilling stir of brass and percussion music as the choreography of bone-crushing tackles in dramatic slow motion flashes across the nation's television screens. based upon the illusion, the country's love affair with professional football has given sports fans confidence that the NFL is an institution unencumbered by corruption. And noting again what Newt Rockne said, or Pat O'Brien, playing Newt Rockne, said in the movie, "We haven't got any use for gamblers around here. You've done your best to ruin baseball and horse racing. This is one game that's clean and is going to stay clean." And the following anecdote concerns George Gipp, the football player whom Reagan played in Newt Rockne All-American. Grantland Rice, by the way, was arguably the most important or best-known sports writer of his day. Grantland Rice often told a story about an incident that occurred during the halftime of a 1920 game just before Gipp's death of pneumonia. Rice reported that he had been told by an assistant coach for the Irish, quote, "Being behind by 3 points, Rock was really laying into the boys. He had about finished, and Gipp, standing nearby, asked me for a drag of my cigarette. Rock looked up and spotted Gipp leaning against the door, his helmet on the back of his head, puffing the cigarette. Rock exploded. 'As for you, Gipp, I suppose you haven't any interest in this game.' 'Listen, Rock,' replied Gipp, 'I've got $500 bet on this game, and I don't aim to blow any $500,' unquote. Rockne said nothing and never disciplined his player who had been gambling on the outcome of his own games. Now, again, the reality of Ronald Reagan's presidency was fundamentally at variance with the celluloid fantasy that has been reinforced so dramatically in recent weeks. Reagan came in under a banner of fiscal conservatism and tripled the national debt in 8 years. He came in under a pledge to fight terrorism, and in fact, his ascension to the presidency was in many ways realized because of the October surprise collaboration with the Iranian fundamentalist terrorists, who still hold sway in Iran. The terrorist boogeyman of the early 1980s was Muammar Gaddafi, who it turned out got much of his terrorist expertise and support from people like Thomas Kleins and Theodore Shackley, some of the Ed Wilson team that was part of the off-the-shelf intelligence operation that later crystallized in a big way under the auspices of George Bush's Iran-Contra machinations. Those same people like Theodore Shackley, Thomas Kleins, and the rest of the Ed Wilson team were also involved with helping to arm Khomeini throughout the 1980s. Some of those same elements involved with arming the Iraqis under Saddam Hussein as well. Reagan's presidency also conducted a, quote, war against drugs, unquote. At the same time, Ronald Reagan's CIA and the same Iran-Contra team were importing huge amounts of cocaine, which in many ways was responsible for, if not creating, exacerbating the drug problem in the United States. But what we're going to take a look at throughout the course of the rest of this broadcast is the reality of what Ronald Reagan has gotten the most credit for, namely having, quote, defeated communism, unquote. I certainly don't hold a brief of the Soviet system, but the fact of the matter is the Soviets were never under our beds. They're not under their own anymore, in my considered opinion. The Soviet Union was more of a threat to itself and its own people than it was to us, their nuclear weapons notwithstanding. The Soviet Union was a basket case. But what we're going to take a look at now is how the Central and Eastern European fascists, who had collaborated with the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit and before that the Third Reich, were brought into the United States, where in combination with the Gehlen spy outfit, they not only presented us with an enormously exaggerated portrait of the Soviet threat, but eventually they were incorporated into the Republican Party in order to counteract Jewish influence within the Democratic Party, and we're going to take a look at how those guys came into the country. They came in courtesy of an illegal domestic intelligence operation called the Crusade for Freedom. We're going to take a look at the people involved in the Crusade for Freedom right now. It was the godchild of Alan Dulles, OSS operative, later CIA director, Sullivan and Cromwell lawyer who invested Wall Street money on behalf of the Nazis, including and especially money from the Bush family. Turning now to a book that we're going to use liberally for the rest of our broadcast, that book is called The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. Of the Crusade for Freedom, we read as follows. As a young movie actor in the early 1950s, Reagan was employed as the public spokesperson for an OPC front called the Crusade for Freedom. Reagan may not have known it, but 99% of the Crusade's funds came from clandestine accounts which were then laundered through the Crusade to various organizations such as Radio Liberty, which employed Dulles' fascists. Bill Casey, who later became CIA director under Ronald Reagan, also worked in Germany after World War II on Dulles' Nazi Freedom Fighters program. When he returned to New York, Casey set up another OPC front, the International Rescue Committee, which sponsored the immigration of these fascists to the United States. Now, these Nazis began coalescing in a big way in the Republican Party under Richard Nixon, a protege of Alan Dulles and a deep participant in the Crusade for Freedom, along with Ronald Reagan and William Casey. Turning once again to the secret war against the Jews, one of the most prominent Eastern European fascists was Laszlo Pastor, the founding chair of Nixon's Republican Heritage Group's council. During World War II, Pastor was a diplomat in Berlin representing the Arrow Cross government of Nazi Hungary, which supervised the extermination of the Jewish population. Pastor labored on the fringes of the Republican Party's ethnic division during the Eisenhower administration, but the loyal fascists were always dropped as soon as the election campaign was over. The ethnic division was allowed to be active only during presidential campaigns. In 1968, Nixon changed all that. According to Pastor, Nixon personally promised to establish a permanent ethnic organization in the Republican Party if he became president. Nixon kept his promise. As discussed in Chapter 5, the 1972 secret Australian memo revealed that the Nixon administration had discovered that fascist groups were useful to get out the ethnic votes in several key states. Nixon needed the Nazi vote to avoid another Dewey debacle as in 1948. Just a few more votes would have made all the difference in Nixon's race against Kennedy in 1960. In several key states, the Eastern European vote could provide the margin for victory in 1968. The road to temptation was clear, and after Nixon won, he approved Pastor's appointment as chief organizer of the Ethnic Council. Not surprisingly, Pastor's choices for filling emigre slots as the council was being formed included various Nazi collaborationist organizations. The former fascists were coming out of the closet in droves. By the way, in addition to Laszlo Pastor, we're going to revisit the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations later on in this broadcast as well. We're going to see how these elements were to coalesce under Ronald Reagan as a, quote, liberation, unquote, milieu. And we're going to take a look at how they realized liberation theory, a doctrine which had its origins under the Third Reich's Eastern Office in World War II. Rather than simply containing the former Soviet Union, it aimed at quote, rolling back, unquote, communism and breaking up the former Soviet Union into its constituent republics. Continuing, the policy of the Nixon White House was an open door for emigre fascists, and through that door came such guests as Ivan Dochev, head of the Bulgarian National Front and chairman of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. The ABN, as we documented in our previous book, had been condemned even during the Eisenhower administration as an organization dominated by war criminals and fugitive fascists. Yet Nixon welcomed them with open arms and even had Dochev to breakfast for a prayer meeting to celebrate Captive Nations Week. Skipping down. During Nixon's Four More Years campaign in 1971-72, Laszlo Pastor again played a key role in marshaling the ethnic vote. No longer a marginal player on the fringes, now he held a key position as the Republican National Committee's Nationalities Director. At a two-day organizing convention in November of 1971, Pastor castigated the ultra-liberal and leftist Democratic Party, which he felt had abandoned ethnic Americans, and boasted of the work he had done to funnel their votes to the Republicans. Several grateful Nixon cabinet members responded with promises of increased federal funding for the favored ethnic groups. Skipping down again. After 1953, the Republican administration changed the rules and even members of the Waffen-SS could immigrate to the United States as long as they claimed only to have fought the communists on the Eastern Front. By the 1970s, Pastor wasn't afraid to associate publicly with former supporters of German fascism. Nor did Nixon seem to care as long as the Germans voted for him. In October of 1971, the second All-German-American Heritage Group Conference received a letter of warm greetings from President Nixon and a note of welcome from Mrs. Nixon, who accepted the title of honorary chairman and noted her own German ancestry. It doesn't take a genius to realize that some of the conference members were not typical German Americans. Among the fascist propaganda offered at the conference were advertisements for books that denied that the Final Solution had taken place. One of the featured speakers had argued that the reports of 6 million Jews killed by the Nazis were, quote, part of a communist Zionist propaganda effort, unquote. The evidence is unequivocal that successive Republican leaderships knew exactly what they were doing and with whom they were working. Nixon couldn't have failed to notice the adverse press the fascists' relationship with the Republican Party was getting, but apparently the votes they could deliver outweighed any doubts he may have had about their credentials. Pastor was absolutely self-confident. He knew that even after the press scandals, the fascists would remain as part of the Nixon team because of the importance of the ethnic fascist vote as a counter to the Jews. Quote, "It was my job to bring them into the Republican Heritage Group's council. In 1972, we used the council as a skeleton to build the heritage groups for the re-election of the president." According to several of our sources in the intelligence community who were in a position to know, the secret rosters of the Republican Party's Nationalities Council read like a who's who of fascist fugitives. The Republicans' Nazi connection is the darkest secret of the Republican leadership. The rosters will never be disclosed to the public. As will be seen in Chapter 16 dealing with George Bush, the fascist connection is far too widespread for damage control. And skipping ahead again, the truth is that the Nazi immigrants were tar babies that no one knew how to get rid of. Dulles had brought in a handful of the top emigre politicians in the late 1940s. They, in turn, sponsored their friends in the 1950s. By the 1960s, ex-Nazis who had originally fled to Argentina were moving to the United States. Everyone turned a blind eye. And still later, we're going to take a look at the role of the elder George Bush, who, when he was chairman of the Republican National Committee during Nixon's second term, installed these same Eastern European fascists from the Crusade for Freedom as a permanent branch of the Republican Party. It was Bush who fulfilled Nixon's promise to make the ethnic émigrés a permanent part of Republican politics. In 1972, Nixon's State Department spokesman confirmed to his Australian counterpart that the ethnic groups were very useful to get out the vote in several key states. Bush's tenure as head of the Republican National Committee exactly coincided with Laszlo Pastor's 1972 drive to transform the Heritage Groups Council into the party's official ethnic arm. The groups Pastor chose as campaign allies were the émigré fascists whom Dulles had brought to the United States under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom. It seems clear that George Bush, as the head of the Republican National Committee in 1972, must have known who these ethnics really were. Columns by Jack Anderson and others had already made it clear in 1971 that Nixon was a little too close to these fascist groups. The Nazis for Nixon problem was one of those scandals that Bush inherited when he took over the Republican National Committee. And skipping down still further, nearly 20 years later, and after exposés in several respectable newspapers, Bush continued to recruit most of the same ethnic fascists, including Laszlo Pastor, for his own 1988 ethnic outreach program when he first ran for president. And that, again, is the concretization of this milieu, not only under Richard Nixon when George Bush was head of the Republican National Committee, but they were also employed on the 1988 Republican campaign, as we've looked at in a number of different programs. Now, what we're going to be looking at during the rest of the broadcast, bearing in mind the Crusade for Freedom, and bearing in mind that this cast of characters that we first saw in the late 40s and early 50s with Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, and William Casey, and later on the elder George Bush, this was to coalesce in 1980 when the same Ronald Reagan ran for president, with the same elder George Bush as his vice president, the same William Casey as their campaign manager and later CIA director. And under the auspices of Ronald Reagan, this rollback or liberation milieu coalesced into a major element of U.S. foreign policy, and the realization of liberation theory ultimately was brought about. We're going to take a look at one of the people who was brought into the United States under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom. And this is a guy named Otto von Bolschwing. Otto von Bolschwing was a key SS officer. He was Adolf Eichmann's superior in administering the, quote, Jewish problem, unquote, for Nazi Germany. He was brought into the United States by Alan Dulles to work for the CIA. He was working for the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit. And most importantly for our purposes, one of his proteges was a woman named Helena von Damm. Von Damm was an Austrian woman. She married a member of the same military intelligence unit as William Clark, Ronald Reagan's second national security advisor. She came to the United States, promptly divorced her husband, became very, very close to Ronald Reagan. She eventually became Ronald Reagan's appointment secretary when he was governor of California. She drew up the lists from which all of Ronald Reagan's cabinet selections were made when he was governor of California. She then jumped to the White House when Reagan became president, and she drew up the lists from which all of Ronald Reagan's cabinet appointments were made when he became president of the United States. And von Damm was a protege of Otto von Bolschwing. I actually played a very small role in breaking the original article about Otto von Bolschwing in the San Jose Mercury News of November 20th of 1981. That article by Pete Carey was called Ex-Nazi's Brilliant U.S. Career Strangled in a Web of Lies. That's almost verbatim, not quite. But I played a very small role in helping to break the original von Bolschwing story back in 1981. But it was von Bolschwing's protege, Helena von Damm, who drew up the lists from which all of Ronald Reagan's personnel selection took place for his presidencies. Turning now to, once again, to The Secret War Against the Jews by Loftus and Ahrens. Eichmann was replaced on the Middle Eastern scene by a far more skilled intelligence officer, Otto von Bolschwing. Before World War II, von Bolschwing set up an import-export business in Palestine as a cover for his espionage activities. He was an educated man from a good family and an enthusiastic supporter of Hitler. After the war, von Bolschwing became one of Alan Dulles' senior agents in the CIA. Dulles helped von Bolschwing emigrate to California, where he established a business association with Helena von Damm, later Reagan's ambassador to Austria. In later years, his business went bankrupt and he was forced to surrender his American citizenship on the grounds that he was a Nazi war criminal. And again, it was his protege Helena von Damm who drew up the list from which all of Ronald Reagan's cabinet appointments were made in for his two terms as president. By the way, it's interesting to note that Helena von Damm keeps the last name of her second husband, Christian von Damm. The last anybody that I know has heard of Christian von Damm, he was head of the Bank America's La Paz Bolivia branch in the early 1980s, and that was at a time when Klaus Barbie and his Bridegrooms of Death Coca Fascisti were holding forth under the García Meza government in Bolivia. We've looked at that in numerous programs. Among the people working for Klaus Barbie, by the way, were people like Joaquin Feeblecorn, Stefano Della Chiai, the author of The Strategy of Tension in Italy, and Pierluigi Pagliai, a member of Licio Gelli's P2 Lodge, as was, by the way, current Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. The fellow who financed Klaus Barbie's trial after he was arrested and brought back to France was François Genoux, whom we've looked at in connection with the founding of Bank Altaqua and other things. Jacques Vergès, currently the lead attorney, or will be the lead attorney, for Saddam Hussein, a protege of François Genoux, was Barbie's attorney in that trial. We're going to take a look inside, too, at how this particular milieu evolved through the years, and we're going to take a look at how rollback or liberation theory was to coalesce under Ronald Reagan. Now, inside, too, some of the names to look at, some of the names we're going to be looking at, again, we're going to review the role of Helena von Damm, a protege of Otto von Bolschwing, and her role in helping to select the cast of characters who were to appear on the stage of the Reagan presidency, and I think that is an appropriate term, an appropriate metaphor under the circumstances. We're going to look at Laszlo Pastor again, only we're going to take a look at how Laszlo Pastor has recoalesced or has reappeared under the auspices of the Free Congress Foundation. That was an extreme right-wing organization in the United States that incorporated many of these Central and Eastern European fascists. And we're going to take a look at Laszlo Pastor, the Free Congress Foundation, and the aforementioned anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, and we're going to take a look at their role in realizing rollback or liberation theory, the breakup of the former Soviet Union into its constituent ethnic republics, something that is taking place, something that eventually did indeed take place. And by way of sort of pinning a supplement to what we're about to hear, we should note that the implementation of rollback or liberation theory and the implementation of some of these Nazi-related elements also had deep implications for U.S. policy in Southwest Asia, and the same elements we see coalescing in connection with the Afghan Mujahideen effort, which was to spawn Osama bin Laden, and some of the Al-Taqwa Grand Mufti-related elements that are currently ranged against the United States. Turning now to the book House of Bush, House of Saud by Craig Unger about George Bush's role in overseeing the Afghan, the elder George Bush's role in overseeing the Afghan Mujahideen effort. Specifically, as vice president in the mid-1980s, Bush supported aiding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan through the Maktab al-Khidmat, or services offices, which sent money and fighters to the Afghan resistance in Peshawar. Bush was in charge of the covert operations that supported the MAK, says John Loftus, a Justice Department official in the 1980s. They were essentially hiring a terrorist to fight terrorism, unquote. Co-founded by Osama bin Laden and Abdullah Azzam, the MAK was the precursor to bin Laden's global terrorist network, Al-Qaeda. It sent money and fighters to the Afghan resistance in Peshawar, Pakistan, and set up recruitment centers in over 50 countries, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and even the United States, to bring thousands of warriors to Afghanistan to fight the Soviet Union. And one of the main devices used for U.S. policy in Southwest Asia was the World Muslim Congress, founded by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. And by the way, the presence of the Al-Taqwa milieu in Washington, D.C., courtesy of the Islamic Institute, was one of the things that was an outgrowth of the Afghan Mujahideen support effort. We've looked in past broadcasts at the incorporation of the Islamist faction of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Community. That basically is an outgrowth of this same phenomenon, namely using anti-communism and anti-Semitism and the sentiments shared by these Islamists as a vehicle for furthering the interests of the Republican Party, and in all probability the presence of the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids that were targeted on March 20th of 2002 was also linked to the use of organizations like the World Muslim Congress, the Islamist element in the World Anti-Communist League, against the Soviets. WFMU archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. There are two addresses, one streaming and one for download only. Long written descriptions of these programs available in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 465, The Gipper and the Underground Reich. This is being recorded on June 20th of 2002. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.